State Department of Taxation and Finance has opened an investigation of Trump for fraud and tax evasion following a major expose by the New York Times. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has also called for a city probe, and Democratic Senator Ron Wyden has urged the IRS to investigate the president. The Times revealed Trump inherited much of his family's wealth through tax dodges and outright fraud, receiving at least $413 million from his father's real estate empire. The Times' 13,000-word investigative report found the late Fred and Mary Trump transferred more than $1 billion in wealth to their children, and much of it to Donald Trump, paying less than 5% of the $550 million in taxes they should have under inheritance tax rates. As part of a scheme to reduce taxes, Trump also helped his parents undervalue real estate holdings by hundreds of millions of dollars in IRS tax returns.
The New York Times also reports Trump earned $200,000 a year in today's dollars from his father's companies beginning at the age of three, with a salary that increased to $1 million a year after Trump graduated college and to $5 million a year when Trump was in his 40s. Over the years, Trump has repeatedly portrayed himself as a self-made billionaire whose only head start was a small loan of $1 million, he would say, from his father. We're joined right now by David Barstow, the three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times, lead author on this new investigation revealing the original source of Trump's wealth. David Barstow shares a byline with Suzanne Craig and Russ Buettner on The New York Times' exclusive Trump engaged in suspect tax schemes as he reaped riches from his father. Welcome to Democracy Now! So you have been attacked by the White House for what you've done, the piece they call old and boring. Tell us first, I mean, this is a massive piece, which is being reissued on Sunday, is that right, by The New York Times?
Yep.
Many-page piece. Headline, Trump took part in suspect schemes to evade tax bills. Talk about how you found this information and what were your key findings, David?
Well, first, how we found it was kind of the old-fashioned way. It was going to courthouses, scouring public records, knocking on a lot of doors, and gradually over many months, piecing together, building this trove of documents, over 100,000 pages by the time we were ready to publish. And I think most significantly, in terms of for people to be able to assess this story, it's important to know that this includes literally tens of thousands of pages of never-before-seen documentation of the actual inner workings of Fred Trump's real estate empire.
Talk about your major findings, particularly what you say is this illegal transfer of wealth.
So I think there's two core findings. One is simply that narrative that Donald Trump has sold to the public for many decades now, the thing that made him famous, that gave him political power, and that ultimately I think was a central focus of his presidential campaign, is this narrative that he is a self-made billionaire. And what this story really reveals is the extent to which that just simply doesn't square with the facts that are uncovered and that we show in this story. So that's sort of, I think, point number one. Point number two is not only did he receive $413 million from his father, not only did he receive another $140 million in today's dollars in loans from his father, but that amount, the amount of money, was significantly increased by a series of tax schemes that the tax experts that we consulted with in our reporting, laying this out to them, said these things go way beyond the normal tax avoidance strategies that wealthy, sophisticated people will employ in any event to lower their tax bill. This was a set of maneuvers that were actually intended to deceive the IRS about the value of things that were being given from Fred and Mary Trump to Donald Trump and his siblings. Those are the two main points, that, you know, there's a huge amount of money flowing, not just when he was a young man, but actually throughout Donald Trump's life, especially when he was in financial difficulties, especially when he was taking on new projects, and that river of money was fed very much so by tax evasion.
Talk about baby Trump. That's baby Donald Trump, mm-hmm. and how he started to accrue this wealth, something very different than he is told.
Yeah. So how does a three-year-old end up making $200,000 a year? Right. That's a good question. Here's how it worked. Fred Trump, Wayne is absolutely right that he was a really great builder in the outer boroughs. But much of his building was actually made possible through federal housing subsidies. He was actually one of the country's biggest recipients of cheap building loans, basically made possible by the federal government. And he used $26 million or so of those cheap loans to build two of his biggest apartment complexes in New York, a place called Beach Haven and another place called Shorehaven, both out in Brooklyn. These are massive, massive apartment complexes, thousands and thousands of units. And so he was building those in the late 40s. And what he did was something quite clever. He put the land underneath the buildings into a trust and made his children the beneficiaries of that trust. And then he had his companies that were actually building the buildings on top of the land sign 99-year leases to pay rent to the landlords, his young children. And so what that meant was that Donald Trump, starting at age three, was Fred Trump's landlord. He was collecting rent payments from Fred Trump's companies. This kind of maneuver, right, setting up these sort of mechanisms, these financial mechanisms that would just kind of create this automatic streams of money that would just sort of month by month by month would trickle into trust accounts or into partnerships and find their way ultimately into the pockets of his children. Fred Trump was just a genius at coming up with new ways, new revenue streams to funnel into the pockets of his children. So he didn't just make his children his landlord. He also made his children his banker. He made Donald Trump didn't just put him on the salary as a vice president of Fred Trump's companies. He also then paid him separately to be his consultant. He paid him separately to be a property manager. He paid him separately to be a purchasing agent. And on and on and on it went. As we gathered up all of the records from inside of Fred Trump's real estate empire, we started counting up how many different revenue streams has he created for Donald Trump through the years. And we got up to 295. That's what we counted, what we were able to document. Some of these things, you know, they weren't in and of themselves big money. Like, for example, Fred Trump funneled the laundry revenue from his buildings to Donald. That's not a lot of money. But when you sort of start aggregating it, putting it all together, it's just this mighty, endless river of money flowing constantly into the bank accounts of Donald Trump.
I mean, one of the things that you do in your piece is you give a very strong sense of the extent to which Fred Trump seemed to have a special relationship with Donald Trump, because you explain that so much of the money accrued to Donald Trump as against his other children. What did you learn about why that would be the case? Also, that the principal illegality, I mean, what you spoke of Beach Haven and Shore Haven, the responsibility for that is Fred Trump's. And is it actually technically illegal, what he did?
In that transaction, there's nothing illegal about that transaction that we've uncovered. That's not the point that I'm trying to make there. That's an example, though, of one of the many different ways that Fred Trump was enriching Donald Trump, starting from a very early age and continuing on up forward. Fred Trump had an older son, Fred Trump Jr., who initially was kind of going to be the heir apparent, right? And Fred Trump really wanted to pass this dynasty on to one of his children. And Fred Jr. was sort of the first kind of natural heir apparent as the oldest son. But he didn't have the passion for the business. He had other interests. He liked to fly airplanes. He loved music. Fred Trump, the father, considered Fred Trump, the son, to be a little too soft, a little too nice. And before long, became clear that he was not going to be the heir apparent. The heir apparent was going to be Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was very aware of his father's disapproval of Fred Jr. He witnessed this. Fred Sr. could be quite cruel. And I think what we see in terms of, this is really from the interviews with people who worked closely with Fred Trump, they witnessed this young man, Donald Trump, sort of watching what had happened to Fred Jr. and almost forming himself into Fred Jr.'s opposite. If Fred Jr. was soft, too nice, well, Donald was going to be a shark. He was going to be a killer. That, I think, is sort of at the core of this father-son relationship, which is very much what this story is about. It is about a father-son relationship. These two men were extraordinarily close. Donald Trump said, we quote him, that he felt that he knew his father better than anybody else in the world. They talked daily. They spent many a weekend together. They were in constant communication. Donald Trump was a constant presence. When Fred Trump would have strategy sessions with his top lawyers, his top accountants, figuring out what his next moves were, Fred Trump was often this sort of silent, lurking presence at Donald Trump's big, flashy press conferences. It was more than just a father-son relationship. It was also a partnership.
You're right. The most overt fraud was All County Building Supply and Maintenance, a company formed by the Trump family in 1992. All County's ostensible purpose was to be the purchasing agent for Fred Trump's buildings, buying everything from boilers to cleaning supplies. It did no such thing. Records and interviews show. Instead, All County siphoned millions of dollars from Fred Trump's empire by simply marking up purchases already made by his employees. Those millions, effectively untaxed gifts, then flowed to All County's owners, Donald Trump, his siblings, and a cousin. Fred Trump then used the padded All County receipts to justify bigger rent increases for thousands of tenants.
I mean, this is something where when Donald Trump says this is old news, I can tell you that no one had ever heard of All County Building Supply and Maintenance. It's never been written about, described anywhere. And this is actually a kind of a remarkable, in a way, when we were peeling back the layers on this, it felt, you know, like one of these sort of gritty scams that you might see in The Sopranos, right? It's setting up this company to make basically huge cash gifts from Fred Trump to his children look like legitimate business transactions. Let me give you just a really simple example. This is one that we describe, and we actually show in the story the actual invoices and purchase orders so you can all see for yourself exactly what I'm talking about. So they set up this company, All County Building Supply and Maintenance. It's not a real company. There's no corporate offices. It's actually headquartered in the basement of Fred Trump's favorite nephew. The owners of All County Building Supply, though, were Fred Trump's four children and his nephew. Anytime Fred Trump was going to improve his buildings, he had to buy stuff, right? And in this case, as soon after they formed this company, they bought 60 boilers, 60 big, expensive boilers from a company in the Bronx. Fred Trump himself personally negotiated the purchase price of these boilers. Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of boilers. The man who sold Fred Trump these boilers, Leon Eastman, told me in an interview that one day he comes back to his office and there's an envelope and there's a check, huge check, from this company, All County Building Supply. He's like, who the heck are these guys? Never heard of them, didn't know who they were. And what that was it was All County Building Supply was paying him the price that Fred Trump had negotiated, but then All County Building Supply would turn around and would send an invoice to Fred Trump for the very same boilers, but the invoice was padded, marked up 20, 30, 50% more. So all it was doing, it was basically, it was just an invoice padding operation. It was taking the things that Fred Trump was already buying, adding 20, 30, 40, 50, 100% more, and then charging Fred Trump. Fred Trump was effectively overcharging himself. That's what it looked like on paper. But in fact, all of those profits are then flowing directly to his children. That's point number one.
And he's not just a child. Donald Trump is like 46
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this was part of a fairly well-considered and orchestrated strategy that the Trump family came up with when they realized, you know, Fred Trump is getting up there in age. He's starting to suffer some ill effects, dementia, other problems. And they're realizing if he dies, all of this empire, all of the buildings and huge amounts of cash sitting in his accounts, those are going to be subject to a 55% inheritance tax. And so the idea was, well, wait a minute, how do we pull that cash out of the empire before it gets taxed 55%? How do we shift all of those buildings into our pockets before they get taxed 55%? In this case, I think one of the things in the all-county building supply case, it helps you sort of see at least the mindset here, is not only do they come up with this ruse, basically, to disguise cash gifts as legitimate business transactions, but then they submitted those padded invoices to the state regulators who govern rent increases in New York. And they use those inflated invoices in order to justify rent increases for thousands of the tenants who lived in Fred Trump's apartments. You know, these are working class, middle class folks who were seeing their rents go up, you know, $5, $10, $15 a month, in part because of these inflated invoices from all county building supply and maintenance.
And can you speak specifically about the Starrett City development in Brooklyn, which Fred Trump made an investment in the 1970s?
So Starrett City is really one of the largest federally subsidized housing developments in the country. It's massive. It's even bigger than Fred Trump's apartment complexes. And in the 70s, when they were trying to build Starrett City, they needed some extra money. So they were looking for private investors. It was basically going to be this investment that would create huge tax losses. That's why rich people wanted to get in on Starrett City. It would create huge tax losses. So Fred Trump could use his losses at Starrett City to shelter all of his profits from his empire. So he made an investment into Starrett City, but he also made an investment for his kids as well. And so Donald Trump, starting at a very early age, was getting these huge tax breaks from Starrett City. In fact, those tax breaks helped him avoid paying any federal income taxes at all in the late 1970s. And then, of course, as time progresses, Starrett City is now worth a heck of a lot of money. It recently sold for nearly $1 billion. And in fact, that investment that Fred Trump made way back in the 70s is going to give Donald Trump a windfall of $16 million this year.
How much money would you say Fred Trump avoided in taxes?
Hundreds of millions of dollars. It's pretty simple math, right? We see that he transferred well over $1 billion in wealth to his siblings. It's a 55% tax rate. So you're talking about a tax bill, an expected tax bill of around $550 million. The tax records that we obtained show that the Trump family paid $52 million in gift and estate taxes. So rather than paying a 55% tax rate, they paid about a 5% tax rate. The question then is, how did they avoid the other $500 million? What happened to that? First of all, just to be clear, we certainly don't say in the story, and we don't allege anywhere that every penny of that was evaded money. Some of it was just usual tax avoidance measures that all rich people use. But certainly a very significant portion of that came through tax schemes and maneuvers that the experts that we consulted with said really crossed the line.
What can New York recoup? New York City, New York State? And are there criminal charges at all here?
I think that clearly the statute of limitations is the big obstacle to any kind of criminal charges. However, we actually don't know what ended up in Donald Trump's tax returns. And so if there are things that he misreported that have their roots in some of the transactions that we're describing in this article, and those misrepresentations carried forward into future tax returns from Donald Trump, that could be potentially problematic because that could maybe take the statute of limitations off the table as an obstacle.
There could be a criminal prosecution?
Potentially, although, like, you know, let's be real here. I mean, the IRS is a much weakened agency. I mean, it's been quite devastated by budget cuts over the years. And certainly the IRS, I'm talking, not talking about state authorities now, I'm talking about the federal IRS, has said absolutely nothing in response to this article. The more realistic accountability that's there is this potential for civil fraud. There's no statute of limitations for civil tax fraud. And so the state tax authorities can be a very powerful weapon if they decide to actually use it to go back and look at these transactions.
Well, let's go to some of the mechanisms that you point to in the piece that Trump used in order to avoid paying taxes. Explain what GRATs are and how they were used.
GRATs are a well-established and legal instrument that's used by the wealthy to pass assets onto their children in a way that allows them to avoid estate taxes. In fact, if you watch TV, you'll often see these commercials from BDO that are actually GRAT commercials. They don't say the word GRAT. It's a technique that when you talk to tax lawyers, they almost get a little misty-eyed about GRATs. They said this is like magic. These things are these incredible devices that assets go in, all kinds of financial gymnastics occur inside of them, and then they sort of assets come out and they're like free of tax. I think the important thing to say about this is that Fred Trump's estate tax return is a very important document. There were three people who signed off on that estate tax return. One was Judge Barry, one was President Trump, and the third was Robert Trump, the president's younger brother. When you sign an estate tax return, you're responsible for the accuracy of that tax return. You're responsible for accurately describing the assets, and you're also responsible for describing all of the gifts that were given by the person in that estate. So what we describe in our story is that the estate tax return that the three of them vouched for, that tax return is grossly inaccurate. It used all of the same kind of techniques that we described in other parts of the story, and it did so in order to make what was left of Fred Trump's empire look like minuscule. I think that's an area that is potentially problematic.
What most surprised you in what you found?
The thing that I think continues to surprise me about Donald Trump is that this is this guy who has been so much in the firmament of our culture and our media for so long, and yet there's so little that we actually know about him and his finances. There's this mountain of interviews, and you know, it's daunting to look at. But when you kind of put all of that aside and just try to get to ground truths with this guy, every time we've done that, we feel like, oh my gosh, whatever the idea was that we thought we had about him, it's quite different when you pull some more layers back.
After Fred Trump's death, you write, his empire's most valuable asset was an IOU from Donald Trump. And you say he betrayed his father and what he wanted with his empire.
Yeah, Fred Trump really wanted the empire to stay in the family. Donald Trump was in some financial difficulty again in 2004, and he was the one who came into a family meeting and said, it's time to sell Dad's buildings. And so they did. And the irony is, the price that they got for all those buildings was actually hundreds of millions of dollars less than what the actual property was worth, according to banking records that we have uncovered.
Shelter,
shopping,
poison rain,
shopping,
rain. streets have no name. Well, the streets have no name. We're still building.
As we hurtle toward the midterm elections this November, many Americans who despair of the future of our nation under Donald Trump's presidency are hoping Democrats will win majorities in both houses of Congress and save the day. But Trump and his party have already done so much damage, rolling back rights and regulations as Trump ushers in an era of white minority rule over an increasingly diverse nation. It is easy to give in to the despair and hope we survive the next couple of years, putting our faith simply in politicians. But a new book urges Americans, at least those of us who reject the notion of alternative facts, that we have far more power than we think we do. Anesha Roy Chowdhury is a writer, editor, and educator, and she joins me to discuss her new book called The Marginalized Majority, Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. Welcome to the program, Anesha.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you open your book sharing a personal anecdote about how you have grown up realizing that you, as a brown woman, are considered an other by a member of your own family. Share that story with us.
Yeah, so my father is Indian. He came over from India kind of recently in his 20s. And then my mother is white American. And her family has been here for a few generations. And I have sort of an ex-uncle now because my aunt divorced him. But growing up, this uncle by marriage, he did not believe in what he called mixed marriage. And so what this actually looked like is that he just refused to speak to me or look at me. And this created a very awkward situation, obviously, made for some awkward dinner table conversations or lack thereof. But I tell this story because I think it is actually not so atypical in American culture. And I think it's emblematic of the fact that racism and misogyny, these kinds of things are really baked into the infrastructure of this country. And it's oftentimes those of us who are marginalized who bear the brunt of just sort of having to normalize or react as though we are the problem in a way. So, you know, growing up, I never said anything to that uncle. It was never really discussed. And it wasn't until I was a grown adult that I really started to reckon with how just messed up this was. But I also feel fortunate that I had that experience because, again, I feel like it offers a pretty clear insight and example of how these forces are just constantly at work.
Right. We have been lulled into, before Trump especially, lulled into a sense of false security that the era of overt racism, racial resentment by whites against people of color is over. That was a thing of the past, the stuff of history books. And then, of course, the shock of Trump's rise brought that all back. And now we see that those racist forces never went away. They were simply lying low. They've come out into the open. They've been emboldened. And that is the most sort of shocking manifestation of what I referred to as white minority rule earlier in my introduction, this idea that a majority minority country, meaning a country that will very soon be majority people of color in states like California, already whites are a minority, that this is a nation that is being set up to have largely white rule. But it doesn't have to be this way. How did you, through this past year and a half under Trump's rule, which has turned out to be worse than any of us could have imagined, how did you fight cynicism?
I mean, I think a big part of why I was moved to write this book is that immediately after the election, I feel like we were just sort of inundated with a lot of narratives in headlines and a lot of news stories all about how we've never been more divided as a country. And obviously there has been, as you mentioned, this resurgence of really blatant racism. But, you know, obviously this kind of racism is institutional. It runs deep. And the fact is that we right now are not more divided than ever. There's a small contingent of extremists. That much is true. But I think it's being blown out of proportion because the media is perpetuating this story that we've never been more divided. And what I came to discover after doing a lot of research and a lot of writing and a lot of interviewing is that there is a divide that's occurring right now. But the divide is not between the majority of Americans. The larger divide at play right now that is more important is the divide between what the majority of Americans want and what a handful of extremists in power are offering. And so I think into this chasm of power, we're starting to see some really encouraging things, which is we see people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez winning. We see Stacey Abrams in Georgia winning. We just saw Andrew Gillum in Florida. And what's interesting to me is that these are people who are campaigning unapologetically about who they are, how their identity impacted their experience of America, and how they're going to address really straightforward issues that the majority of Americans are concerned about, whether it's access to healthcare, education, really basic things that the majority of Americans can get behind. And yet what we still see, which is so frustrating, is this ongoing reaction in the media that, oh my God, what an upset that these people are winning. It's totally unexpected. And in reality, I think it's the least surprising thing in the world. We're just seeing people who are finally speaking to the needs and desires of the majority of Americans.
You brought up Andrew Gillum in Florida. He is the first Black nominee for governor of a major party in Florida's history. The day after he won that primary race, his opponent, Ron DeSantis, went on the media and said things like he was an articulate spokesperson, which is a sort of a backhanded racist compliment, and then actually went as far as saying the last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda with huge tax increases and bankrupting the state. For a white man to say monkey this up about a Black man is such a straightforward racist term that it seems as though Trump and his fellow Americans, because it's not just Trump, are using racism as their major and only platform, campaign platform. They offer scapegoating people of color, white minority rule, white supremacy versus everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's disturbing to see, but at the same time, it seems like such a last gasp effort in a lot of ways. The reality is, as you mentioned, that the direction this country is going in, that we are increasingly a majority of brown people, immigrants. And I feel like what we're seeing is this sort of last gasp of people grasping at this power, of this minority trying to hold on to power. And in reality, when you look at the breakdown of Americans, it's roughly 31 to 32% of Americans are white male. So when you look at the constitution of who makes up America here, we're talking about brown people, immigrants, queer people. And then if you also include white progressive allies, we already are the majority. So, you know, while I find this racist dog whistling extremely problematic and disturbing, I also feel like to be preoccupied with the notion that these people are going to have the power and have the power and will inevitably continue to have the power is just simply not true. What we need to do is continue to support candidates, run for office also, who are speaking to the majority of Americans, who are getting out the vote. You know, I think one of the best interviews I saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez after her victory was on the late night Colbert show. And he addressed, you know, he was like, well, how did you do it? You know, like the numbers, the breakdown, it had you so far behind. How did you do it? And she very matter-of-factly said, well, you know, when people talk about getting out the vote, generally when polls are run, what happens is they're polling the likely voters, right? And she was like, well, what we did is we just got out the vote among people who don't typically come out and vote. And I think that that's is something that I hope more Americans pay attention to. When we look at these polls that are perpetuated through headlines and circulated on Facebook and everywhere else as though they're a marker of what's definitely going to happen. I mean, I think we saw in the presidential election that clearly polls are failing us. And the reason is there's a large contingent of Americans who are not coming out to vote that we need to reach out to. That's where a lot of our focus needs to be.
Now, one of the presidential candidates who did generate incredible excitement among those people who don't ordinarily vote is, of course, Barack Obama. And you also write in your book, The Marginalized Majority, how you let Obama's election serve as a bomb. And this is a really important part of the discussion, of course, because there's a reason why Trump was able to win the Electoral College, scraping through a win when he should have basically been at the very bottom of the barrel. He shouldn't have even won the Republican nomination, and then he shouldn't have won the Electoral College. But Democrats and the establishment Democrats bear a big part of the blame because they have simply been complacent and not really prioritize the interests of a majority of Americans who are struggling, whether those Americans are white or non-white.
Absolutely. And I think what we're seeing now is the majority of Americans, what they want is just categorically far to the left of what establishment Democrats and Republicans. And I'm saying Democrats because that's important. You know, we're talking about how they are failing repeatedly to address what the majority of Americans want. And so they need to recognize that in order to win, which there's never been a larger opportunity than now to really cultivate voters, to really speak honestly and frankly to the gross disparities in equality and privilege and status in this country, and literally to just speak straightforward truth. We're seeing time and again in different elections that that is what is winning. So I really hope that they take the hint. And even if they don't, the fact is the voters will force them to.
Anisha, your book subtitle is Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. I wanted to address that issue of the post-truth America because Trump, if there's one thing he's skillful at, it's manipulating media coverage, manipulating the narrative, setting the agenda so that only what he wants to be discussed will be discussed. His claims of fake news, even as he has become the president who has spewed more lies than any other president in history, unfortunately are quite effective. So all of these issues coming up that Americans can have clarity over in terms of common agenda, etc., can still very easily fall prey to the scourge of really fake news, right? And that's a big battle, the battle over what reality itself is. It sounds new, but of course it's an old battle because authoritarian regimes have always used propaganda to make their case.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you characterized that, you used language that was really important, which is like letting them set the agenda, right? And I think this is tricky terrain. I spend a lot of time thinking about it. But the fact is, progressives and folks on the left, we're always following the news. We're always reading. And we have a tendency to fall easily into defensiveness. And I think that the problem comes when we are just sort of following the latest absurd thing that Trump is saying on Twitter, right? We're letting that dictate the parameters of what we're talking about. And so the tricky line, I think, is that obviously, we need to be paying attention to what Trump is doing in as much as it has real repercussions and effects on Americans every single day. But to be mindful of the fact that this is someone who comes from reality TV. This is someone who feeds off their ego being stroked. He wants attention. And so I think it's important to not be so distracted by whatever sensational thing he said that we surrender the terms of the argument. We surrender the terms of what we're really talking about. And I feel like if we do that, we lose. So we just need to be mindful of not letting this handful of extremists who are in power totally co-opt the conversation.
There's also the very critically important issue of winning the culture war, if you will. And this goes back to our conversation around how racial resentment gets effectively whipped up. How we talk about these issues is so critical. The language we use, the framing we use. You point out in your book that we have come to a point in the United States, which may be an indication of kind of how low things have gone, where we trust comedians more than we trust journalists. And of course, this is also an age-old phenomenon, the court jester who can tell the truth while others can't because they use comedy as a tool. How important are comedians to this moment? Comedians were very powerful during the George W. Bush era. He was perfect fodder for comedy. It feels as though Trump is so depressing that even comedians are having a hard time effectively making fun of him, or maybe not. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think political comedy has become extremely important. And in part, it points to some media failures. And I think that there are a lot of newsrooms right now that are really trying to take stock of how to be responsible when you're covering someone who is so abusive of power like Trump. One of the major problems there is that while we talk about objectivity as being this sort of paragon of journalism, in many newsrooms, it's not defined. And so what happens is you just have this more subtle policing of tone and content.
Brothers and sisters came working the fruit trees, and they rode on the trucks till they took down and died. Well, some are illegal and some are not wanted. Our contract is out and we've got to move on. 600 miles to that Mexican border. They chase us like outlaws, like rustlers, like thieves. Adios, mi Juan, adios, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesús y María. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be deportee. We died in your hills and we died in your deserts. We died in your valleys, we died on your plains. We died neath your trees and we died in your bushes. Both sides of that river, we died just the same. The sky plane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon, like a fireball of light. Says they were just deportees. Adios, mi Juan, adios, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesús y María. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be deportees. Qué manera de sembrar a la tierra y qué manera de crecer nuestra fruta. Como hojas secas pudren en la sierra y qué manera.
thing when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be C-14.
Welcome to Surviving the Matrix, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Maxwell Egan. It's a pleasure to be with you once again. Something else that we are witnessing at the moment, which is really quite in everybody's faces as well, for those who are looking in this direction, is the controlled demolition of the independent media. And this is really going forward in leaps and bounds as well, folks. It started off with the whole Pizzagate scandal and the way Pizzagate was controlled and focus was purposely shifted towards the pizza store, which ended up in the attack against the pizza store, which saw the creation of the entire fake news meme. This was all very predictable. I actually called that before it happened, and this led to the demonetization of many people's YouTube accounts, and I called that before it happened as well. I told people that they need to be careful of monetizing their YouTube accounts because it was a trap, and this is one of the reasons I never monetized mine, because I knew it was going to be a short-lived experience anyway, and all you're really doing by providing these details to YouTube is giving them access to your bank account and all of your personal details, and you're adding more to the control grid and adding more to the surveillance system and simply doing it for a few dollars, which really don't mean anything anyway and which will soon be taken away from you. And that's exactly what they've done with the demonetization of YouTube. And this is all about the destruction, the controlled demolition of the independent media. But it's really being pushed a little bit further now, and the Trump presidency is contributing to this as well. You know, as I said a few months ago, just after Trump came to office, it appears that Donald Trump is simply the blunt instrument of the New World Order. It really does, folks. He's just someone who has pushed the agenda forward with an extreme amount of brutality, and he's done so with relative ease compared to what they were doing before Trump came to office. I mean, the neocons had a plan, but it had been bogged down for a very, very long time, probably because of the corruption of people like Hillary Clinton, the enormous amount of profits she was making on the way, the enormous amount of profits of companies such as DynCorp. But Donald Trump has simply come along with a new business plan, a new way of pushing the agenda forward, and he's come along as a blunt instrument, and he's just done it. And he's creating so much instability at the same time, and I think this is still very much on the case, and I think that much of the global situation that's being contrived at the moment is pointing towards this. I think even the controlled demolition of Alex Jones is pointing towards this. The independent media can be blamed for the rise of Donald Trump and the huge amount of instability we've seen in the world since this narcissistic egomaniac took office. And it's all been contrived, and it's all been one big play, and it's all been done to justify the destruction of the independent media, and will also bring about a massive amount of control over the internet, folks. I think Flat Earth will do this as well. Now, once it gets out that so many people now believe the Earth is flat, and this is all because they've got information from the internet, you're going to find that so much of the internet changes, and that the entire internet landscape ends up something vastly different to what it is today. I mean, it's changed a great deal in the last 10 or 15 years anyway. The internet used to be fantastic. 15, 20 years ago, the internet was an incredible place where you could find anything you wanted to find. Now it's unfortunately turning into one big shopping mall controlled by Facebook, and that seems to be the internet. Facebook is taking over the entire internet, folks. For many people, the internet is Facebook, and that's a very, very sad thing. That's why I don't spend too much time on Facebook anymore, because it's just a problem, and it's just a means of controlling the flow of information so that people don't get access to anything, because there's so many algorithms that control the flow of information on Facebook. Even people who are friends with you, even people who follow your page, don't get to see what you post, folks, not unless you pay for it. And this all just contributes to giving Mark Zuckerberg more money, which allows Mark Zuckerberg to steal more of Hawaii. So what's the point of doing that? You know, people need to get off Facebook and start surfing the internet again and start finding websites that work again and sharing their information in forums rather than on Facebook, because we log onto Facebook and we do so because we think we've got so much connection there with people, but really you're only connected to a few people, folks, only the ones that they allow to see your posts. And your information doesn't get shared, it gets locked away and controlled, and all it does is give the government tabs on you and let them know what you're thinking. That's the purpose of Facebook. The police used to have to go to an enormous amount of trouble and expense to find out personal information about people, but now they just have to go to Facebook and everybody's put it all there for them anyway, along with all their friends and all their contacts and everything they've been doing for the last 7 years, and it's all there. It's all there on Facebook, and that's all the authorities need to be able to track you. And again, we use these sites because we believe that it's a way of sharing information, but really the information just doesn't get shared, and that's the problem. You know, the way we got here, folks, the way we got to have this incredible amount of freedom and information that we've got now, the way we did it originally was by surfing the web and finding information on websites and sharing the information in forums and emailing each other and going to chat rooms and doing all this sort of stuff. But now something more convenient came along, which is Facebook, and we've all shifted over to that. And what is Facebook, folks? Essentially, Facebook is just a big forum. It's a big forum, only it's moderated by people who sympathize with government. That's all it is. It's like the forums we used to go to in the old days, but there's a lot more people involved in it, but the government is the one who moderates the forum. So what is the point of that? You know, we go there and we think it's really cool because we can post pictures and we can upload videos and all these things. Well, we could do that in old forums that we used to go to anyway. So why don't we just use the old forums? How do we get convinced into switching over to a forum, a big forum, which is moderated by the government? Because that's essentially all Facebook is. Think about it. And now everything is completely controlled. You go into Facebook now, there's no news on any of the home threads. There's just people making their comments about what they had for dinner or creating these really ridiculous memes, these coloured pictures with a little bit of text in it. And I don't know what this is for. I don't even know why people would bother doing that. But we're not seeing any real information there anymore, folks. And like I said, we need to remember our roots and remember where the information came from originally, and go back to those sources and go back to those methods of doing things. Not allow ourselves to become enslaved to the convenience that has been put out there for us to consume, because all this convenience leads to control. I've said this very often, folks, all the way people do things on their mobile phone now, all the apps, everything's done in a way which is more convenient for you. You know, taking tellers out of banks, taking checkout operators out of supermarkets, and creating situations that they claim are more convenient for you, so you don't have to wait in line. That's why they make you wait in line, folks, because they want you to get annoyed with it, because then you'll accept the new conveniences that they bring in, which are all about control of your life. These things aren't really convenient, folks. They're convenient for the authorities to get control over you, but they're not really convenient for you. You know, they seem convenient for you because you've allowed the authorities to corral you into these untenable situations and make you wait in endless queues simply so they can roll out this convenience control grid for you. And it's our willingness to buy into it that is the problem. You know, I see so many people buying into it and so many people taking it for granted. I know so many truth activists that have the Facebook app on their phones. I know so many truth activists that have the new iPhone with Siri on it and actually think it's convenient that this phone talks to them. They don't think it inconvenient that the phone is listening to every conversation they have. They don't think it's inconvenient that these phones are tracking them everywhere. And they are simply complying with the system by their use of these products, folks. You know, you can be an activist and you can talk about how the world is going to hell and you can talk about the control grid that's coming down all your life, but if you're using these things, if you're using your mobile phone to do all these things, if you're shopping without cash and using your credit card to buy stuff, if you're using this control grid and participating in it at all, then you're part of the problem. I mean, I don't understand why people who are awake would be out there shopping with credit cards. I don't understand why people who are awake would be installing these apps on their phones and using their telephones for anything other than making phone calls. I don't know why people would be doing this and participating in this system while they're speaking out against it. Because it's this AI convenience system, which is the control grid, folks. And if you are participating in this system, if you're buying a new laptop with Siri on it, or you're buying a new laptop with Cortana on it, or you've got a new iPhone with Siri on it, or you're using your credit card for shopping, then you are supporting the rollout of the digital control grid. And I don't know why you're bothering to speak out against the system. I really don't, because it's this passive acceptance of it and this passive use of all of these so-called conveniences that they give us which is creating this control grid. And if you really want to stop the control grid rolling out, folks, then you need to stop using the conveniences that they are giving you, which are in fact the control grid itself.
Yeah. This entire show is basically going to be one long recap of one very long week. And one event in particular, meaning that sadly there is going to be no time to talk about Trump insisting that the UN was laughing with him and not at him, which it absolutely wasn't. Nor is there going to be time to delve into what was clearly the most fun story of the week, this.
Well, the Philadelphia Flyers have a new mascot. And fans are saying, what the? That's 7 foot tall Gritty. Gritty unveiled today in front of a group of kids, probably scarred for life.
Yeah. Yeah, those kids should be scarred for life. Gritty is fucking horrific. Every single photo of him is appalling. I mean, look at this one. That is a nightmare. How about this one? That is simply psychotic. Gritty looks like the end result of the orange McDonald's fry guy hooking up with Grimace. And we've been over this a million times before on this show. If you're a McDonald's mascot, you do not have sex with another McDonald's mascot. Your genetics are too similar and their kids always turn out weird. Very, very weird. And incidentally, it's not like Gritty has any business being a hockey mascot.
Apparently he hasn't really figured out how to navigate on the ice yet. He fell multiple times in his debut last night. The Pittsburgh Penguins tweeting, LOL, okay. To which Gritty responded, sleep with one eye open tonight, bird.
Holy shit, Gritty, calm down. They're just engaging in some inter-team banter and you've gone straight to, I will murder you in your sleep. And look, there is absolutely nothing that I would love to do more tonight than talk about Gritty all night long. From the fact that he's already done a Kim Kardashian-style photo shoot, to the fact that, and this is true, someone has already got an actual tattoo of him on their body. Interestingly, that someone, Jimmy Carter. Unfortunately, though, the fun we just had must now stop, because instead we need to talk about Brett Kavanaugh, Supreme Court nominee and walking crushed beer can. Now, on Thursday, Christine Blasey Ford, who was accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her in 1982, came before the Senate Judiciary Committee to deliver some powerful testimony.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
Right, and she did just that, describing in detail her recollection of how a drunk Kavanaugh pinned her down, tried to remove her clothing, and put his hand over her mouth when she tried to scream. She insisted that this could not possibly be a case of mistaken identity because she was 100% certain that it was him. And after her opening statement, she then took questions, which sometimes took an odd turn, like when the prosecutor to whom the Republicans had outsourced their responsibilities seized on a polygraph test that Ford had passed.
Did you pay for the polygraph yourself?
I don't think so.
Okay. Do you know who did pay for the polygraph?
Not yet, no.
I believe you said it hasn't been paid for yet. Is that correct?
Let me put an end to this mystery. Her lawyers have paid for her polygraph.
As is routine.
whoa. Slow your roll there. As is routine, don't you try and brush her question aside. She just cracked this case wide open. She found the missing piece of the puzzle, specifically a puzzle that reads, "Who fucking cares?" Ford's testimony was brave and compelling and seemed to affect many on the committee, including Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, who chose to express his admiration in a far from ideal way.
Have you found Dr. Ford credible?
Well, it's too early to say. I don't think she's uncredible. I think she's an attractive, good witness, but it's way early.
What do you mean by attractive, sir?
Oh. In other words, she's pleasing.
Oh! Pleasing. You should not use the word pleasing to describe a sexual assault survivor painfully recounting one of the worst moments of her life. You honestly shouldn't really use it to describe anything. Maybe watching milk mix into your coffee. Except, you know what? Not even then. Because the moment you say, "Watching this milk is pleasing," you come off like a creep who's waiting for everyone to leave the room so he can fuck his coffee. The point is, by lunchtime on Thursday, it honestly seemed that Kavanaugh's nomination could be finished. Even Fox News was implying as much.
This was extremely emotional, extremely raw, and extremely credible. And nobody could listen to her deliver those words and talk about the assault and the impact it had had on his life, on her life, and not have your heart go out to her. This is a disaster for the Republicans.
That is Fox News calling Ford's testimony a disaster for the Republicans. And not like one of those Puerto Rico disasters, you know, this time one they might actually care about. But then came Kavanaugh's testimony. And it is worth looking at it in detail tonight, because in every regard, it could not have been more different from Ford's. For starters, while she was remarkably composed in discussing traumatic details, Kavanaugh came straight out of the gate weird in his opening statement, not just denying all her allegations, but almost breaking down while attempting to paint a folksy image of his time in high school.
I worked out with other guys at Toby's house. He was the great quarterback on our football team. And his dad ran workouts.
Yeah, he's crying at the memory of lifting weights at his friend Tobin's house. I hate to say it, but I'm starting to think that men might be too emotional for the Supreme Court. Also, he'd be really pretty if he just smiled more. And it wasn't just memories of a high school quarterback that was making him tear up.
I've always had a lot of close female friends. I remember talking almost every night, it seemed, to my friends Amy or Julie. Or Kristen or Karen or Suzanne or Maura or Megan or Nikki. The list goes on.
Okay. That's not testimony, though, is it? That is a plaintive spoken word cover of Mambo Number 5. I remember my friends Angela, Pamela, Sandra, and Rita. And as I continue, you know they're getting sweeter. Wah, 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 wah. But when Kavanaugh was not choking back tears, he was starting to get noticeably angry, arguing that he was the victim of a giant conspiracy.
This allegation was unleashed and publicly deployed over Dr. Ford's wishes. And then, as no doubt was expected, if not planned, came a long series of false last-minute smears designed to scare me and drive me out of the process before any hearing occurred. Crazy stuff. Gangs, illegitimate children, fights on boats in Rhode Island.
I mean, come on! Do I seem like exactly the type of person who would get into a fight on a boat in Rhode Island? Seriously, you tell me! When you picture a fight on a boat in Rhode Island, do you just picture two of me yelling at each other at exactly this pitch and volume? Is that what you're saying? That if you wanted my haircut, you would tell your barber to give you the fight on a boat in Rhode Island? Well, I would like to see you say that to my face on a boat in Rhode Island. And that's all I have to shout about that. Fuck you! I'll see you on the water! And remember, what you've just seen was him reading from a prepared statement. It got even stranger once he started taking questions.
Did you consume alcohol during your high school years?
Yes, we drank beer. My friends and I, the boys and girls. Yes, we drank beer. I liked beer. Still like beer. We drank beer. The drinking age, as I noted, was 18, so the seniors were legal. Senior year in high school, people were legal to drink. And we drank beer. And I said, sometimes probably had too many beers, and sometimes other people had too many beers. We drank beer. We liked beer.
Yeah, I get that. I do. I get that loud and clear, Brett. But the question isn't really, do you like beer, is it? It's how much do you like it? Just like how the question in Jeffrey Dahmer's trial wasn't, do you like people? It was, do you like people to a really problematic extent? And when pressed on his drinking, Kavanaugh became either dismissive or outright hostile. And it was at those moments that you got a real sense of who this man actually is.
What do you consider to be too many beers?
I don't know. You know, whatever the chart says. I like beer. I don't know if you do.
Okay.
Do you like beer, Senator, or not? What do you like to drink?
Next one is...
Senator, what do you like
Judge
to drink?
You're saying there's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened.
That's, you're asking about, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Could you answer the question, Judge? That's not happened. Is that your answer?
Yeah, and I'm curious if you have.
Okay, so first, aside from being deeply disrespectful, have you is just not the answer of an innocent person. If you ask someone if they ever blew a dog and they go, I don't know, have you? That person blew a dog. He blew a fucking dog, and in all likelihood, not just one either. And that surly tone was emblematic of Kavanaugh's demeanor throughout the hearing. Not the tone of a man who hopes to one day have the honor of serving on the Supreme Court, but the tone of someone who feels entitled to be on it and frankly can't believe that you're being such a dick about this. And that actually does make some sense, because this is a man who has had every imaginable advantage. His elite high school, and this is true, has its own 9-hole golf course. Now, am I saying that someone who went to a school with its own golf course should not be on the Supreme Court? Yeah, I think I am. Yeah. Honestly, I didn't plan to when I started that sentence, but here we are, and I'm going to stand by it. But Kavanaugh didn't just rely on belligerence to refute Ford's charges. He brought evidence, specifically a calendar from 1982, about which he was, and I know this will shock you, weirdly emotional.
Why did I keep calendars? My dad started keeping detailed calendars of his life in 1978. He did so as both a calendar and a diary. Christmas time, we sit around and he regales us with old stories. Old milestones, old weddings, old events from his calendars.
Now, look, I know that it may seem cruel to make fun of a man crying over his late father's calendars, but what if I were to tell you that his father is still alive and was sitting right behind him? That's him there! And that is why I am now completely comfortable saying that every Christmas we'd gather round and Dad would regale us with old events from his calendar is the single weirdest fucking thing I've ever heard anybody say. And to make it weirder, remember, Kavanaugh just said that his dad started keeping calendars in 1978, when Kavanaugh was 13, meaning he would have been 14 at the time his dad had even a single calendar to read to his children from. And an adult man reading last year's calendar to his 14-year-old son is literally the saddest Christmas I can imagine, other than being one of the innocent people who gets murdered in the movie Die Hard. That is literally the only other example. And the truth is, Kavanaugh's calendar may not have actually helped him. Because while he told the panel he never attended a gathering like the one Dr. Ford describes in her allegation, in fact, his calendar shows at least one similar event with at least two of the people Ford named in her letter. And Kavanaugh misrepresenting the truth actually became something of a really troubling pattern. For instance, he repeatedly made this strong claim to poke holes in Ford's story.
I just want to reemphasize, all four witnesses who were allegedly at the event have said it didn't happen, including Dr. Ford's longtime friend, Ms. Kaiser.
Except this 53-year-old frat pledge is actually significantly misstating the facts there, because in reality, three of those people merely said that they didn't recall the party as described, and Ford's friend, Ms. Kaiser, did specifically say she believes Ford's allegation. And the fourth person there is Kavanaugh himself. So Kavanaugh just wildly mischaracterized evidence, and that is one thing a judge really should know not to do. It's basically that and don't tuck your robes into your blue jeans, because it's objectively a bad look. Then there was the fact that for all of Kavanaugh's talk of his wholesome teenage years spent respecting women for their friendships and doing sick reps in Tobin's dad's house, his high school yearbook tells a very different story. For instance, he and his bro friends brag about being Renata alumni, referring to a girl that they knew. Now, Kavanaugh claims that that was completely asexual and just clumsily intended to show affection and that she was one of us, which is a little hard to believe given that A, Renata only just found out about it and said the insinuation is horrible, hurtful, and simply untrue, and B, if it was just affection for a friend, where's the alumni society for Amy? Or Julie, or Kristen, or Karen, or Maura, especially Maura. Maura most of all. Now, Kavanaugh had similarly implausible explanations for other terms in the yearbook, specifically those commonly associated with drinking or sex.
Have you, I don't know if it's buffed or boofed, how do you pronounce that?
That refers to flatulence. We were 16.
Let's look at Beach Week Ralph Club biggest contributor. What does the word Ralph mean in that?
That probably refers to throwing up. I'm known to have a weak stomach and I always have.
Devil's Triangle.
Drinking game.
Bullshit! The term Devil's Triangle is commonly known to refer to a threesome involving two men and one woman. So I'm just not buying that unless all your drinking games were named after widely recognized sex acts. Oh, doggy style, drinking game. You pour vodka in a bowl and you lap it up while wearing only a dog collar. A fisting, drinking game. That's gripping a Shiraz in each fist and toasting the progress of feminism. 69ing, absolutely drinking game. That's listening to Bryan Adams' hit song Summer of 69 while uneventfully drinking a beer on the porch. Even C-SPAN callers were not buying this whole drinking game defense.
Go ahead, Carl.
Hi, I just wanted to echo a few things that another caller said, which is that a devil's triangle is certainly not a drinking game. It's an encounter with two men and a woman. Blasey.
We'll go next to Mary in Bronxville, New York.
I like to imagine that that guy calls in every day to describe what a devil's triangle is, and that was the only day he stood even a chance of getting all the way through his explanation. And look, while it may seem unbelievably petty to give this much attention to a high schooler's yearbook, you have to remember that to some extent, many were watching this hearing to try and ascertain who was more trustworthy. Was it the terrified psychology professor who blew up her entire life to relive her trauma on a national stage? Or was it Judge Animal House who seemed to be sweatily making up drinking games before members of the Senate? And yet, for some senators, Kavanaugh's poor performance was completely immaterial as they had already made up their mind. Orrin Hatch, taking a break from being pleased, made the broad case that it was ridiculous to even ask questions about an event that took place such a long time ago.
This is a national disgrace, the way you're being treated. There's been no whisper of misconduct by him in the time he's been a judge. What we have are uncorroborated, unsubstantiated claims from his teenage years.
Now, that is clearly a shitty, disingenuous argument, though, although I will give Hatch credit for invoking the phrase teenage years with the voice of a 13-year-old whose balls are literally dropping mid-sentence. Now, as for Lindsey Graham, he turned his performative disgust at the process up to 10.
This is the most unethical sham
since I've been in politics. And if you really wanted to know the truth, you sure as hell wouldn't have done what you've done to this guy. You're looking for a fair process? You came to the wrong town at the wrong time, my friend.
Okay, first of all, Lindsey Graham sounds like the least intimidating sheriff in the entire Wild West. You turn back around and get back on your horse, Mr. Man, because what you're looking at is the soft, tender little baby face of justice. You came to the wrong town at the wrong time, my friend. The wrong time. Pew, pew, pew. Baby face. Justice. Get on your horse. Ride. But look, second, Lindsey Graham is not actually wrong there. He looks like a doll that's not allowed to be within 50 feet of a playground, but he is not technically wrong. This process was deeply flawed, but that is because he and the Republican majority designed it that way. If they wanted to avoid a he said, she said situation, they absolutely could have, but instead, they only called two people, so we only heard what he said and what she said. A much fairer process would have involved gathering evidence and hearing from others, like Kavanaugh's classmates, in particular, his high school friend Mark Judge, who Ford says was in the room during the alleged assault, but that is not how Republicans chose to set up the hearing. And for all Kavanaugh's emotional appeals about wanting his name cleared, he was repeatedly asked about whether he supported an FBI investigation, and he consistently dodged the question.
Judge Kavanaugh, will you support an FBI investigation right now?
I will do whatever the committee wants to...
Personally, do you think that's the best thing for us to do? You want to answer?
Look, Senator, I've said I wanted a hearing, and I'd said I was welcome anything.
You'll welcome anything. Just say you will support an investigation. You've been accused of a heinous crime that you insist you did not commit. If I were Kavanaugh, I would be desperately trying to prove my innocence in every possible way. FBI investigations, polygraph tests, sworn affidavits from not only Mark Judge, but also all my other boys from G-Town Prep. I'm talking about Tobin, Timmy, Squee, PJ, Cumrug, Tooks, Merck, C-Dubs, Dirty Pete, Fat Andy, Spliff Dog, the Horn Dog, Bonowitz, Bonowitz's older brother J-Money, and Shit Dick. You know, character witnesses. And look, at this point, let's actually pull back and look at the picture of Kavanaugh's character that we now have. Because even if you don't think he's guilty of sexual assault, or even if you think that it's impossible to say whether he is because it happened in his teenage years, even then, there should be plenty in what we saw this week to cause you real concern. Because a key part of the job that he is up for is judgment and temperament. And this week, we saw Kavanaugh talk over the top of senators, dodge questions, and conflate doesn't recall something happening with deny something happened, which is, again, a fucking important distinction for a judge. Not to mention, he repeatedly wept at the concept of calendars. And there was one more important moment that I would argue is disqualifying in and of itself. Because ideally, a Supreme Court justice should make decisions independent of politics. Kavanaugh himself has stated the court must never be viewed as a partisan institution. And he is right about that. And yet, in his opening statement, a document he had time to draft and consider, his tone was positively Trumpian.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups.
Now, that is absolutely horrifying. And it is worth taking a moment now to note the norm that has just been shattered. Because I know that we're all basically calloused to people talking that way now, but we are supposed to have at least 9 people left in America who do not talk that way. And yet Kavanaugh just all but came out and said that he's going to approach his entire tenure as one giant case of me versus the fucking libtard cucks. And this brings me to the most basic question that remains. Why? Why this particular asshole? Why is he the hill that conservatives are willing to die on? And I do know that for some of Kavanaugh's most ardent supporters, this is a purely ideological issue. Senators may not say it out loud, but this woman for Kavanaugh did.
I'm hoping it gets in personally. because I want abortion to stop. Even if it turns out he's guilty, I think I'm still going to support him, and I hope he gets in, because this could be a good chance to overturn abortion.
Okay, so it's fine. It's fine to appoint someone who has committed sexual assault to the Supreme Court, as long as they will curtail abortion rights. It's a stance that prioritizes human lives. As long as you think life begins at conception, stops right before a sexual assault, and then starts right back up again as soon as that assault is over. Now, obviously, I personally do not agree with that. But even if ending legal abortion is your ultimate goal, there are many conservative judges who could deliver that to you without all of Kavanaugh's issues. Because purely as a judge, there is nothing unique about Kavanaugh. Nothing. He's not uniquely qualified. Trump reportedly picked him from a list of 25 names provided by outside groups like the Federalist Society, whose executive vice president explicitly pointed out he had no preference regarding the list.
Is there a leading contender for you?
No, there's not.
Really not?
No, the list is really good.
They're not in order? You're just saying
no, anyone? No. You can throw a dart at that list and in my view, you'd be fine.
Wow. He answered that question about Supreme Court justices like he was just asked which pickle in a jar is his favorite pickle. I don't know, man. They're all pickles. It's a pickle jar. So if it's in this jar, it's a fucking pickle. But for some reason, the Republican leadership is continuing to push Kavanaugh hard. In fact, on Friday, Lindsey Graham seemed to view Kavanaugh with even more relish.
I've never felt better about him being on the bench than I do right now.
Senator. Really? You feel better now than before Kavanaugh testified? Do you really mean that? Or are you afraid that if you don't say it, Kavanaugh will challenge you to a fight on a boat in Rhode Island? Because I do get that. He seems like the type. The point is, after all of this, I genuinely cannot see a single good reason for pushing Kavanaugh over a replacement candidate. Because you know, deep down, any judge they choose is almost certainly going to restrict abortion rights. You don't need to choose an unhinged partisan with multiple accusations of sexual misconduct hanging over him. So it feels like they're doing this just to deliver a fuck you to Democrats, and even more directly, a fuck you to women. Because when this week began, the biggest fear for many was that the committee would not believe Christine Blasey Ford. But by the time the week ended, it seemed that something darker might have happened. Because it seemed their response was, oh, we believe you, we just don't care. And the tragic thing is, she knew this was a possibility. She said so explicitly during her testimony.
Once he was selected and it seemed like he was popular and that it was a sure vote, I was calculating daily the risk benefit for me of coming forward and wondering whether I would just be jumping in front of a train that was headed to where it was headed anyway and that I would just be personally annihilated.
She knew publicly reliving the most traumatic event of her life could have absolutely no effect on anything, and yet she spoke up anyway. It is absolutely incredible the lengths that some people will go to for a free polygraph test. And look, here's the thing. I am not saying that this is a done deal just yet. They were desperately pushing Kavanaugh through on Friday, only for extraordinary pressure to force the reopening of the FBI investigation, which, by the way, may well end up being so limited as to be essentially pointless. But the fact is, only continued pressure has even the slightest chance of stopping Kavanaugh's confirmation. And if he does, as seems increasingly likely, make his way to the court, we should never forget how that happened or what he represents. We certainly will not forget it on this show. You may know that for years, we've had an all-dog Supreme Court with dogs playing the justices, from Samuel Alito to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Right, good dog. Don't die. Good dog. Sit, and don't die. Now, since 2017, it's actually been a mostly dog Supreme Court because Neil Gorsuch is represented on it by a lobster. That's because his seat was stolen from Merrick Garland, therefore, like a lobster, he does not belong there. But Kavanaugh, if he is seated, doesn't even deserve that treatment. He deserves something that constantly reminds people who he is, something hostile, consistently unsettling, temperamentally unpleasant, and that screams, who the fuck allowed this to happen? So I pray that we will not have to use this. But if we do, I see no more fitting embodiment of Kavanaugh than this. Yes, that's right. Just as the actual Supreme Court should not have to deal with Kavanaugh, our animal Supreme Court should not have to deal with this mutated carpet swatch that appears to be tweaking on bath salts. I truly hope it does not come to this. And look, there is still a chance that we can stop it, so please call your senators tomorrow and tell them you do not want to be looking at this for the next 30 years. Get off the bench. You're not even confirmed yet. No, I don't want a beer. I don't want a beer, you big weirdo. Get off that bench, you entitled monster.
Once upon a time, at the foot of a great mountain, there was a town where the people known as Happy Folk lived. Their very existence a mystery to the rest of the world, obscured as it was by great clouds. Here they played out their peaceful lives, innocent of the litany of excess and violence that was growing in the world below. To live in harmony with the spirit of the mountain called Monkey was enough. Then one day, strange folk arrived in the town. They came in camouflage, hidden behind dark glasses, but no one noticed them. They only saw shadows. You see, without the truth of the eyes, the happy folk were blind.
Falling out of aeroplanes and hiding out in holes, waiting for the sunset to come, people going home. Jump out from behind them and shoot them in the head. Now everybody dancing, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead.
In time, strange folk found their way into the higher reaches of the mountain, and it was there that they found the caves of unimaginable sincerity and beauty. By chance, they stumbled upon the place where all good souls come to rest. The strange folk, they coveted the jewels in these caves above all things, and soon they began to mine the mountain, its rich scene fueling the chaos of their own world. Meanwhile, down in the town, the happy folks slept restlessly, their dreams invaded by shadowy figures digging away at their souls. Every day, people would wake and stare at the mountain. Why was it bringing darkness into their lives? And as the strange folk mined deeper and deeper into the mountain, holes began to appear, bringing with them a cold and bitter wind that chilled the very soul of the monkey. For the first time, the happy folk felt fearful, for they knew that soon the monkey would stir from its deep sleep. Then there came a sound, distant first, that grew into gastrophony, so immense that it could be heard far away in space. There were no screams. There was no time. The mountain called Monkey had spoken. There was only fire. And then, nothing.
Oh, a little town in the USA, the time has come to see. There's nothing you believe you want. But where were you when it all came down on me? Did you call me home?
From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
I do not have attention deficit disorder. I have surplus attention capacity syndrome.
And now, back to our story.
I have your medical records.
Why am I here?
Why are you wearing perfume?
my wicked stepsister.
It's my new fragrance, Brute Stench, the fragrance of man boy billionaires. You know, it stinks. Your entire family is a biological dead end. You have no empathy genes. Psychopaths and sociopaths have no capacity for empathy.
I really don't care. Do you?
What do you care about, dear?
Clones are people, too.
Are you all clones?
It's just a gig.
Are these your medical records?
Let me see that.
You have ODD, oppositional defiant disorder.
Again, these are my confidential medical records.
Cool, dude.
Privacy, dude.
I told you, privacy is a bug in the system.
Steve Bannon is my birth father.
How did you discover that?
I never let him kiss me. I really don't care. Do you?
Oh, sometimes I'm a swing voter. I have submissive obedience syndrome.
Submissive personalities are highly valued in society.
Really?
But you won't rebel until you're conscious.
Why not?
Do you expect a compliant rebellion?
Well, I do. I want a compliant rebellion. The wine and cheese and a lovely massage.
Is that a motion?
Second.
You can't second your own motion.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
The motion fails.
Who counted the votes?
What is a conduct disorder?
I might have that. What can I take for it?
Take my word for it.
Or take a vacation.
Consider having a steamy affair with a porn star.
Was that your idea?
To get him off my back.
Why are you admitting this?
Because you put truth serum in the tea.
It's just show business.
Show business is real. Elections are fake.
Really?
How deluded are you?
Well, I'm a swing voter.
You like being deluded.
I'm hooked on this stuff. I mean, I was at the parade and I saw some really fine delusions.
Can you be more specific?
I'd rather not, but okay. I saw a wiener dog wearing a dildo. I mean, I saw a naked woman on a scooter, and those scooters are illegal. And then we were all singing, "We're all a family under one sky. Just a family under one sky." Who knew?
What are you saying?
Well, on Klonopin, I can be dangerously calm in an emergency.
But the side effects are great. You will love them.
Delusions are a drug.
I took half.
A half delusion?
Maybe I need the other half.
Would you settle for some false hope?
Do you have any?
I have a tweet here that says non-commercial radio is trending.
Why now?
Oh, the proles are waking up. The proles and the clones together.
Is that what you believe?
Me? Oh. Well, I believe that commercials are bad, but public service announcements are, they're not all that great either.
I have one.
Go ahead.
A man in Scotland was arrested for teaching a dog to perform a Nazi salute.
Arrested?
For teaching his dog to perform a Nazi salute?
What happened to the dog?
The dog got off scot-free.
Scot-free is an ethnic slur. The scotch I drink is very expensive.
Scot-free is an insult to rich white people who don't pay taxes.
My ancestors owned Scotland, dude.
Can I see the receipt?
Ivanka, show him the receipt for Scotland.
The bank has it.
The bank owns Scotland, not you.
And who owns the bank?
I own everything, dude.
I own half of everything.
It's going to be a messy divorce.
Who gets custody of Baron?
Donald has Baron on alternate weekends.
My father is teaching me everything he knows.
There is more to life than drawing a big crowd, but not much more.
I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is TwitWit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time. Before we go to round three, are there any announcements?
I have an announcement.
Go ahead.
Everyone has a chance to have a full and prosperous life.
That's not an announcement. That's an aspiration.
No, it is not. It is a trick. I don't want a chance. I want a guaranteed basic income.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And I want it now.
Me too.
Can you be more specific?
I can't retire until I'm 97.
You must be very productive.
Well, thank you. I am. I was. But not anymore. People are afraid to be detained for laughing at my jokes.
Is that supposed to be funny?
Is anyone laughing?
Maybe the audience is laughing on the inside.
Laughing on the inside throws off my timing.
Oh, that's... I've got the giggles.
Laughing on the inside is a suspicious activity.
I'm getting very angry about this.
What are you going to do about it?
I'm going to burn my voter registration card.
Why didn't you retire sooner?
I can't afford to buy myself a gold watch.
Is that all you want?
No, I want universal health care.
Fat chance.
Everyone deserves a fat chance to have a prosperous life.
I want more than that. I want to be a traitor to my class.
Baron, if you become a traitor to your class, the president will disown you, and the Pentagon will disable your internal navigation system.
I can't believe I live in a world like this.
Are the clones waking up?
I have to make a confession.
You signed a non-disclosure agreement, General Mattis. You cannot confess to anything.
I did not have sex with that man.
Me? General Mattis. I'm falling in love with you.
Keep it to yourself.
I'll try, but will you have me?
That's a gotcha question, and I don't answer gotcha questions.
Will you endorse my candidacy for president someday?
I'm running for first woman president as a Democrat.
But aren't you a Republican?
Whatever. Does it matter?
I understand what you mean. I like the way the Republicans abuse me better than how the Democrats abuse me. But the choice is yours alone.
But the little people are waking up.
Waking up is okay, but please, no more acting up.
Anyone who acts up will be shot.
Can't we fire them and get some new little people?
Well, that's a clever idea. Yes, let's do it.
General Mattis, we have been over this.
I know, but I can't find my notes.
I call the question.
Oh, yes. All in favor?
No.
The motion fails for lack of a second.
Victory is ours.
Support this network. Don't. Special thanks to Bonnie Hughes and the Berkeley Arts Festival.
The ghost of Madame Blavatsky is in the lobby.
Madame Blavatsky? Wait, isn't she dead?
How would I know?
No, not dead, but yes, I am from the astral plane. Some have called me a medium. It's true. I arrange consultations with deceased loved ones.
Why are you here?
Pacificor Radio Network is a target for a hostile takeover. Dark forces are working to destroy alternative, non-commercial radio as we know it. George Soros hates analog radio.
Why?
Analog radio signals are impossible to trace. Nobody knows who is listening.
But isn't privacy a good thing?
Don't be a dumbkopf, my child. Stupid billionaires want to monetize your listener data. But it's difficult to monetize listener data with analog radio waves. But if the network fails, vultures in the party will fix the network and use it to elect...
Who's gonna believe that?
Do you want this network to be owned by Dracula?
Dracula?
Dracula or Frankenstein? Do you want fake elections used to win your consent for endless war?
I'm voting for Einstein the dog in the California Senate race.
No, wait, but we're too young to vote.
I vote by mail.
Do your parents know?
It was their idea.
In the astral plane, we only vote in local elections.
If the guy wants to live a lifestyle that is only possible because our government tortures people, you can't go out with me. No way. I have to get to know you first. And I like a little pillow talk afterwards, but please try to have something original to say, because if you don't know what happened at Ground Zero, how can I trust you to care for me? I don't date people who condone torture. Most guys who condone torture make lousy lovers. Don't you know about Karl Marx?
Karl Marx. Is that what you want?
I think Karl Marx is hot.
Welcome to Better Bad News.
Yeah. Capitalism is immoral and the root cause of the environmental devastation. Why don't you eat my shorts?
Can we have a civilized discussion about this?
This discussion is out of control. If you want a controlled conversation, read the Huffington Post. Welcome to Better Bad News.
I wouldn't want to have a father who tortured prisoners for a living. What am I going to see on Take Your Daughter to Work Day? No, thank you.
My daddy is a torturer.
Just make the torture stop.
My daddy is a torturer.
Do you want it to get worse?
Tell them stop doing it or you will burn the house down. Get your brothers and sisters to chant. My daddy is a torturer.
If I protested,
my daddy is a torturer.
They would fire my ass.
But then your daughter would be proud of her father instead of being ashamed of him.
My daddy is a torturer.
Do you want it to get worse? I think we may need a safe word.
You have oppositional defiant disorder.
We need more people in the world with oppositional defiant disorder. And we need fewer people with submissive obedient syndrome. You have SOS.
I didn't know that I could have that. It wasn't made available to me. I had to not pay attention to things all by myself. Without any kind of disorder to help me with it.
Who's on the line?
Ivanka Incorporated. I'm raising my offer to $200 million. Take it or leave it.
The subscribers won't approve it.
Each subscriber can receive a share of the purchase price. Are you a subscriber?
I need to consult with my calculator. Surrey? What is $200 million divided by tens of thousands of subscribers?
Each subscriber receives 2,857 cents.
Uh-oh.
Five.
I can't remember if I renewed my subscription.
Donate $25 today to become a member and share $200 million tomorrow.
Ivanka's trying to corrupt the membership.
Number one, the network is priceless. Number two, it's not for sale.
The membership decides that, not you.
I think we should hold out for more.
We can't afford not to accept this offer.
Who is going to expose government lies if we lose the network?
Community radio is so boring. After the sale is finalized, there are going to be some program changes.
What program changes?
Steve Bannon is going to replace Amy Goodman, and a Sunday morning children's show will be hosted by Jeffrey Epstein.
You can submit a program proposal to program committee.
There is no program committee.
Exactly.
Oh, can you tell us something about your program ideas?
There will be animal sacrifices and spirit cooking.
Spirit cooking? So you really are a Democrat.
And that concludes this week's TwitWit Radio, featuring Lori Holt, Mantra Plonzi, Karen Ripley, Kenneth McGee, James King, Logan Fry, and Berkeley Kid, that's me. I have a tweet here that says the CIA is secretly running intelligence agents for Congress in the 2018 midterms.
Why is no one talking about this?
Which CIA candidates running for Congress are favored to win?
I want a straight answer.
I'm going to rule against that.
On what grounds?
Undercover agents do not reveal their methods and procedures when bringing democracy and peace to the world by secretly running for Congress in the midterm elections.
Roll the clip.
Intelligence agents running for office isn't anything new. George Bush Sr. was a CIA agent and even later served as the director of the CIA before riding Reagan's coattails into the White House. And of course, as we all know, Bush, after becoming vice president, weeks after Reagan was sworn in, a friend of the Bushes tried to assassinate him, which would have given the ruling class the president they really wanted, the ex-CIA director, George Bush. So forgive me if I'm a little bit suspicious of CIA operatives running for office, which there seems to be an awful lot of in the 2018 midterm elections.
New age is upon us, and yet the past refuses to rest in its shallow grave. For those who hide behind the false image of the Son of Man shall stand before God, 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 God. It has begun, the beginning and the end. Yeah. Voice of racism preaching the gospel is devilish. A fake church called the Prophet Muhammad a terrorist. Forgetting God is not religion, but a spiritual bond. And Jesus is the most quoted prophet in the Quran. He bombs innocent people trying to murder Saddam. When you gave him those chemical weapons to go to war with Iran. This is the information that they hold back from Peter Jennings. Cause Condoleezza Rice is just a new age Sally Hemings. I break it down with critical language and spiritual anguish. The Judas I hang with. The guilt of betraying Christ who murdered him, stole his religion, and painted him white. Translated in psychologically tainted philosophy, conservative political right-wing ideology. Glued together sloppily, the blasphemy of a nation. Got my back to the wall cause I'm facing assassination. Guantanamo Bay, federal incarceration. How could this be? The land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous Holocaust, and the home of the slaves. Corporate America, dancing offbeat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sponsored terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still wanna take me to prison. Just cause I won't trade humanity for patriotism. It's like MK Ultra, controlling your brain. Suggestive thinking, causing your perspective to change. They wanna rearrange the whole point of view of the ghetto. The fourth branch of the government wants to settle. A bandana full of glittering generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror. But what's reality? Read about the history of the place that we live in, and stop letting corporate news tell lies to your children. Flow like the blood of Abraham through the Jews and the Arabs, broken apart like a woman's heart abused in a marriage. The brink of holy war, bottled up like a miscarriage. Embedded correspondence don't tell the source of the tension, and they refuse to even mention European intervention or the massacres in Jenin. The innocent screams, U.S. manufactured missiles and M16s, weapon contracts and corrupted American dreams. Media censorship blocking out the video screens. A continent of oil kingdoms bought for a bargain. Democracy is just a word when the people are starving. The average citizen made to be blind to the reason. A desert full of genocide where the bodies are freezing, and the world doesn't believe that you're fighting for freedom, cause you f***ed the Middle East and gave birth to a demon. It's open season with the CIA bugging my crib, trapped in a ghetto region like a Palestinian kid, where nobody gives a f*** whether you die or you live. I'm trying to give the truth, and I know the price is my life, but when I'm gone they'll sing a song about immortal technique. Who beheaded the president and the princes and sheiks? You don't give a fuck about us. I can see through your facade like a fallen angel standing in the presence of God. Bitch, they get scared of the truth when it looks at you hard. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brain, suggestive thinking causing your perspective to change. They want to rearrange the whole point of view in a ghetto. The fourth branch of the government want us to settle. A bandana full of glittering generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror. But what's reality? Martial law is coming soon to the hood to kill yo, while you hanging your flag out your project window. Yeah, the fourth branch of the government, aka the media, seems to now have a retirement plan for ex-military officials, as if their opinion was at all unbiased. A machine shouldn't speak for men, so shut the fuck up, you mindless drone. And you know it's serious when these same media outfits are spending millions of dollars on a PR campaign to try to convince you they're fair and balanced, when they're some of the most ignorant and racist people giving that type of mentality a safe haven. We act like we share in the spoils of war that they do. We die in wars. We don't get the contracts to make money off them afterwards. We don't get weapons contracts, nigga. We don't get cheap labor for our companies, huggin'. We are cheap labor, huggin'. Turn off the news and read, huggin'.